Once upon a time, the ability to draw was seen as the first and most essential skill of any artist. But in the age of the unmade bed and the pickled shark, drawing's widely perceived as an old-fashioned activity. Many modern art schools don't even teach it, preferring to arm their students with digital or video cameras. I'd like to challenge the tedious modern prejudice that it's trendy not to draw, and that those who do draw are sad reactionaries, stuck in a dead past. I think the exact opposite's true. Drawing is the single most fruitful and vital artistic skill at work in the world today. Over the next few weeks, I'll try to show how drawing lies behind almost everything around us in the modern world. After all, the building I've just been sketching started life as just a few lines on a page, and then, through a series of more and more detailed drawings, was transformed from a figment of the imagination into a monument on the London skyline. The car that brought me here today was once nothing more than a sketch on a designer's drawing board. The same's true of my mobile phone, my suit, drawings everywhere. There's no end to the pleasure of unlocking the secrets of drawing. It has so much to say about how artists think, look at the world, express themselves on the page, and about how we communicate with each other, telling stories through the timeless language of pictures. But first, I'll be looking at how we've used drawing to get to grips with the world around us, to grasp its beauty, but also to grapple with our own place within it. I'll be tracing the stories of some remarkable people, a series of pioneers who were the first to visually capture many of the wonders of our planet. I'll be following in their footsteps. I'll be, so to speak, taking a line for a walk, and through the drawn image, exploring the world's animals, its landscape, and our own human selves. You might think it's a ridiculous claim to say that drawing is so important it can be the difference between life or death. But sometimes it can be. This is Francis Wells, one of the UK's leading heart and chest surgeons. Every day he performs operations that can transform people's lives. It's an intense, exacting process that requires extreme concentration. So often, before he gets to work with the scalpels and forceps, he prepares himself with pen and paper.
Surgery is all hand-eye coordination, and all surgery happens up there, not there. The surgery, what makes a good surgeon is decision-making during the operation. For example, this is sitting in my office. It's a scrap of headed notepaper where I was just working out how I might do a particular operation before I went to do it, thinking of where the incisions are and what to do. This is not done as a drawing to be exhibited. This is a personal drawing to think about what I'm actually about to do. And if you're not afraid of drawing, then it's a wonderful tool.
Can I have the forceps? So, we're just using this as an exercise, but also to show truly. We had cleft all the way back.
But Wells doesn't stop at using drawing in preparation for surgery. He can also be found sketching at the end of actual cardiac operations. In these situations, his medium changes from pen on paper to patient's blood on paper. It might look strange, but what he's doing is sharing knowledge, giving an instant replay of the procedures to those around him.
I made a
the operation has a pace about it. You can't just stop every 5 minutes and say, well, you know, this, that, and the other. So I find it a very good way when the operation's literally finished, the bit inside the heart, and you're waiting for the heart just to restore normal rhythm and so forth, you can actually convey what you might be doing in an operation. It is actually a wonderful medium to draw in, because in cardiac surgery you dilute the blood, and you can have blood that's pure blood or blood that is slightly diluted. And as one knows with people like Turner and so forth, who use different strengths of media, you can actually use different strengths of blood, and it really does produce some wonderful pictures.
The tradition of drawing as a medium used by those in the world of science as much as the world of art is centuries old. It was, after all, one of the first ways in which we understood human anatomy and how our bodies function. So it is that Wells's exacting surgical skills have been shaped by a remarkable series of studies made around 500 years ago by the great master of the Italian Renaissance, Leonardo da Vinci.
There is no anatomy book ever produced over time that can match the beauty of these drawings. You pick up these drawings and the sheer beauty of them. It is not just someone who can think and can apply sort of constructive thought. He can draw in such an engaging and beautiful way that you want to look at the drawings for other reasons. That is why I say even now, even in 1,000 years' time, you can have a dialogue with these drawings.
Leonardo began his groundbreaking studies in the late 1400s, initially so he would better understand what made up the bodies that he drew and painted. Curiously, he had no actual training in anatomy or dissection. His research was ultimately a kind of giant compulsive project to satisfy his own voracious curiosity. For Leonardo, to study the functioning of the body was, in a way, to understand the soul. Among the greatest are these immensely complex drawings of the human skull. They're beautifully drawn, beautifully precise, full of rich detail, right down to the structures of the teeth. And in this one, he even attempts to pinpoint the seat of the soul, the sensus communis, hitting on what we now know to be the pineal gland. To draw is to look and look again, to take nothing for granted. Drawing was how Leonardo saw and thought, how he unlearned the mistakes of medieval anatomy and grasped some of the human body's most intimate secrets. In some cases, it would be hundreds of years before science finally caught up.
For example, if he describes the mechanism by which what you eat in your stomach doesn't spill back into your throat all the time. And that has only been worked out in the last few years. And the way he's thought through this predates modern thought absolutely. He drew from what he regarded as the truth with honest insight and observation. So you can actually start to communicate with him, and if you do that and you take these drawings seriously, there is information here which is relevant to modern day cardiac surgery.
Really?
Absolutely.
In the early 1500s, Leonardo's project culminated in a series of obsessively intricate studies of the human heart. And in a truly across-the-centuries collaboration, Francis Wells has actually used them as the basis for a pioneering form of surgery. He's studied how Leonardo broke down all the individual components of the heart, its openings and closings, the way the muscles expand and contract, how blood flows in and out, but, most importantly, how the valves operate. Leonardo had been studying the behaviour of liquids at the same time. He worked on dams and canal systems. And I think that must have helped him to understand the liquid engineering of the heart. One of his great insights was the realisation that the coils or vortices formed by blood flow are a vital part of the closure mechanism of the mitral valve, a fundamental component of the heart's efficient functioning. Leonardo's insight has led Francis Wells actually to change the way he operates on the mitral valve. And I know for a fact that the procedure, call it the Da Vinci cut, has been turning people who could barely walk into people who can run up the stairs two at a time.
Do you think that these drawings contain within them other things that people haven't still quite twigged yet, if one, you know.
Oh, I'm sure there are. I mean, one has to be careful in not romancing it too much and saying the solution to all our problems are here. They're not. But I think the essence of what we're seeing is someone who is absolutely, conspicuously honest. They're searching for the truth. Nowadays, by thinking about these observations that he made and taking it seriously, it can take you down lines of thought that you might work out yourself with other information that's available.
Leonardo's project was very much in keeping with the spirit of inquiry of the Italian Renaissance, a time when science, art, and philosophy were all part of the same bubbling melting pot. The Renaissance biographer Vasari, never a man to avoid going over the top, wrote that Leonardo was marvelously endowed by heaven with beauty, grace, and talent in such abundance that he leaves other men far behind. But he didn't leave everyone behind. And another dramatic leap forward in our understanding of the natural world also occurred in Italy, less than a century after Leonardo's death. Here in Rome in 1603, an organization was founded that gave new impetus to the Renaissance cross-pollination of fine art and the natural sciences, the Accademia dei Lincei, the Academy of the Lynxes, named after the all-seeing eye of that sharp-witted animal. The group was a sort of cross between a scientific academy and a gentleman's club. It even numbered Galileo among its ranks. But in the field of drawing, the academy is significant for one man, its eccentric driving force, Cassiano del Pozzo.
Cassiano recognized that he was living through a sudden explosion of new scientific knowledge, the period that saw the invention of the microscope and the telescope. Optical tools that enabled new ways of seeing and of drawing. Now, drawing became very important to Cassiano as a way of feeding his own insatiable scientific curiosity, and he conceived the extraordinary idea of commissioning a vast collection of scientific drawings, one that was to contain all of human knowledge, as well as convey that knowledge in a direct visual form. It was a vastly ambitious scheme, and he called it Il Museo Cartaceo, the Paper Museum.
Under the lynx-like gaze of the Lincei's present-day director, I was allowed to look at some of the drawings which the Academy still owns. Cassiano spread the word about his great project all over Europe and commissioned hundreds of artists from many different countries to depict anything and everything the natural world had to offer. 400 years on, the drawings are still spellbinding. These vibrantly coloured depictions of different species of birds look as if they might have just been completed yesterday. The reach of the paper museum was widespread. The living, the dead, animal, vegetable, mineral. Not just one type of artichoke, for example, but every type of artichoke. By the time the project reached completion, it numbered around 15,000 drawings and watercolours in total. But if you really want to uncover the secrets of the Museo Cartaceo, you need access to the Royal Library at Windsor, because in one of his emphatically least mad moments, George III bought the lion's share of the surviving drawings in 1762, and they've been here ever since. Cassiano was a multifaceted man, but if he had one interest above all others, it was ornithology. So it's no wonder that some of the most spectacular drawings in the Paper Museum feature birds, like this almost life-size pelican caught in wonderful living colour. But turn to just a few other sheets from the more than 5,000 kept here at Windsor, and you quickly get a sense of their almost bewildering variety. There are drawings of all sorts of things. A mutant two-headed melon. Some Roman cutlery and cooking utensils. A vastly detailed depiction of a civet cat. A little too detailed, if you ask me. As well as being a museum, it's a paper labyrinth. So to guide me through the maze, I turn to expert Martin Clayton.
The paper museum, I think almost of it sometimes as a kind of intellectual road system, where you've got these roads that lead nowhere and then these big highways that do seem to point towards the future of science.
But it's only in retrospect that you can see that, of course. They didn't know those roads were going to lead nowhere, so they investigated every phenomenon of nature that they could to see what would come of it.
And was this... what's this, then?
This is a broccoli, a monstrous broccoli.
A monstrous broccoli.
Yes. And we have to assume it's life-size. They used a microscope for some investigations, but little is magnified in this way, and so we assume that this was a monstrous broccoli.
And it falls into the category of the freak of nature.
Exactly.
Just so lovely to see them.
This is one of the many hundreds of drawings of antiquities which Cassiano collected. It's one of 8 drawings of a find in a, presumably in a tomb in central Italy, a Samnite set of armour. And Cassiano had 8 drawings from different artists of different pieces of this armoury. From the same grave, we have this beautiful, beautiful drawing of 2 sides of the breastplate.
Wow.
You can see the puncture wound which goes in there and had come out there.
This
is one of very few drawings, maybe the only drawing that we can identify in Cassiano's collection, from the hand of Nicolas Poussin.
This is by Poussin?
Yeah. On the grounds of style, I think we can be pretty sure about that. He was, of course, one of the great artists of the 17th century in Rome, and Cassiano was his greatest patron. He owned 40 paintings by Poussin. But this is the only drawing that Poussin seems to have executed for the paper museum.
In fact, it's one of the few drawings that can be attributed to any specific artist. For the most part, the individual plates Cassiano compiled, often bound into beautiful volumes by subject matter, are done in a straightforward, objective style. The thing itself was what really mattered. The thing, in this tome, being Roman antiquities, both beautiful and bizarre.
What are these, Roman...
Roman spoons?
Spoons?
The back of a mirror.
Oh, that's beautiful.
This is nice, you have the front and back of the same object.
Is that a man with a penis on his head?
Yes, it's a man with a penis on his head. It's a good luck charm, and it records that it was in the collection of Cardinal Barberini, so...
good old Cardinal Barberini. Oh, dear.
You could look at the paper museum and think, what an outlandish eccentricity. Every piece of plant life, every fruit, every mushroom. But behind this wonderful cornucopia of images lies a serious purpose. The paper museum's the very foundation stone of modern science. It established the ground rules for empirical scientific research. It may have taken years and years of drawing, but what it said was this: in human knowledge, no progress can ever be made without finding out everything you can about everything there is. Cassiano looked at everything, but sometimes insight comes when you focus on just one thing, drawing it again and again to get to its very essence. For me, no one demonstrates this more clearly than the great 18th century artist and scientist, George Stubbs. His fixation on his principal subject, the horse, culminated in some of the most viscerally brilliant anatomical drawings the world has ever seen.
So what was it that drew Stubbs to the subject that was going to preoccupy him for virtually his entire working life? Well, in the first place, I think it was simply money. He recognised that there was a great opportunity in mid-18th century England for a painter who could truly master the anatomy of this splendid animal, because the principal patrons of the time, the milords of Georgian England, were themselves fascinated by horses, by their breeding, by their racing, by riding them. And they wanted an artist who could paint their animals more accurately than any artist before. But as Stubbs became really involved in the subject, as he delved deeper and deeper into the anatomy of the horse, rather like Leonardo, he ended up discovering much more than he needed simply to paint the animal. In fact, he created one of the great artistic, scientific projects of investigation of the entire 18th century.
Stubbs was truly a master of the equine form. His ability to capture the weight and grace and poise of the animal is thrillingly visible in this portrait. And it really is a portrait, not just a horse painting. Whistle Jacket. A picture that glorifies the majestic animal against a boldly blank background. His genius in capturing this pose was a direct result of the scrupulous anatomical drawings he'd produced a few years earlier. Drawings that got him, quite literally, right inside the structure of his specialist subject.
I think one of the most impressive things about Stubbs is the sheer obsessiveness with which he went about studying the anatomy of the horse. You have to imagine this. Here he is. He's a young provincial portrait painter, the son of a tanner from Liverpool. He's got very little money, but he's got this great ambition, these grand ideas. So he saves and he saves, all the while going about the drudgery of painting the faces of Lord What's-His-Name and Lady Whoever, until he's finally hoarded enough cash to take a whole year and a half of his life out to pursue pure research. This was unheard of at the time. He was taking a great risk with his career. So what does he do? He rents an isolated farmhouse in the middle of the countryside, and he procures the carcasses of a number of dead horses, and he begins to study them. He even erects a complicated series of winches and pulleys so that he can draw them in positions that they might have assumed in life. At times, he studies an individual carcass so deeply and for so long that the body rots, and there's an incredible stench. The air is thick with flies. The carcass is seething with maggots. Talk about immersing yourself in your subject matter.
Stubbs would take the animal apart stage by stage so that skin would give way to muscle, then the veins and nerves, and finally the skeleton, all the while studying with a razor-sharp analytical eye. They're among the great hidden treasures of the Royal Academy, and they're great works of art in their quality of tone and line. But I also think they're apt symbols of Stubbs's muscular, totally unsentimental intelligence. Thinking about the horse led him to redraw the bigger picture of world science. He was one of the first thinkers to see through the old biblical myth that man was created apart from the animals. And in Stubbs's Comparative Anatomy, a series of very late drawings, you can feel his intense curiosity about the similarities between the human skeleton, the tiger, and the humble chicken. If we're so different, you can sense him wondering, how come our structure has so much in common with theirs? He was asking the question that would soon force an answer from Charles Darwin in the shape of the theory of evolution. Stubbs's project wasn't simply a byproduct of the English gentry's horse mania. It was absolutely in keeping with the European Enlightenment's drive for the rapid progress of all human knowledge. And not just knowledge about our own earthly planet. Since Galileo's Renaissance fascination with telescopes and astronomy, it was thought that to truly understand who we were, we had to explore the mysteries of the universe. This idea came to obsess another 18th century Englishman, the portrait painter John Russell.
In 1764, Russell got his first chance to look at the moon through a telescope, and that was it. He never quite recovered from the experience. He drew a sketch of it, his first actual record of what he'd witnessed. But when he got his hands on two telescopes of his own, that was when his great project really began.
Over a period of 20 years, he built up a series of incredibly detailed studies of the moon's surface. Looking through the telescope, transcribing, looking again. Often he'd stay up all through the night because that was when a particular part of the moonscape was clearest.
The most monumental product of all his labours was this fantastic, beautiful drawing, really a huge work in coloured pastels, which is 5 feet square. Russell was so meticulous in his approach that he even designed his own crayons to execute it. As far as he was concerned, his was to be the biggest and most accurate depiction of the moon's surface ever made. And so accurate is it that you could easily mistake it for a photograph at first glance.
But if you think this is impressive, you should see the hidden stash of detailed sketches he did in preparation for it. Over 180 still exist, a couple of them bizarre flights of fancy, with an angel hovering against the lunar surface. But Russell was meticulous, making complex notes in a shorthand invented by Lord Byron. These drawings truly are a well-kept secret, but how much do they really tell us? I put the question to the man who recently attempted to launch a rocket, not to the moon, but to Mars, head of the Beagle 2 space mission, Professor Colin Pillinger.
As Russell said, they were a snapshot in time of the moon. He used to organise his day so that he could observe at night, but he would only observe about 10 days of the month. And his, they're not so good as a historical record because he was particularly fascinated by painting only, the moon during the first quarter.
But that's fantastic, isn't it?
That is fantastically detailed. You couldn't wish for something as good as that with a camera, almost.
If you took a bit of time over it, do you think you could actually identify...
Absolutely, no doubt you could identify the craters individually from these pictures.
Another one.
There would be absolutely no problem at all. You can see here where the moon is only 250,000 miles away with a 6-inch telescope, which is what he used. You could get extraordinarily detailed things. And you could imagine him presumably thinking, well, it would be nice to go there. That is just fantastic. It's again this picture of the light formed on the limb of the moon, where you can see the deep shadows when you get close to the edge.
Do you think he would have been keen to sign up for the Apollo project?
Oh, undoubtedly, but he presumably would have been one of those people that they probably would have wanted to take. Because in those days, like when the Voyages of Darwin, they didn't have a camera, so they would take an artist.
Exactly.
So Russell would have probably been enlisted for the Apollo programme, he'd have been on the fourth mission, take him along to draw the craters.
He would have been in heaven.
He would have been definitely in heaven. I'm sorry, that's a pun, but...
Russell's lunar mission was, in its way, a parallel to Stubbs's intensive studies of the inside of the horse. Both were working painters with clients to satisfy. Both had a private obsession that preoccupied them in their spare hours for years on end. And what strikes me as most comparable about them is that they both seem to point the way to so much in the future of science and exploration. Drawing deepened man's preoccupation with nature from the Renaissance to the Enlightenment and drove the development of modern science. But this wasn't a purely European phenomenon. As the 18th century turned into the 19th, the new world of America was eager to mark its territory and put its wildlife on the map. One of the first people to take on this challenge wasn't a trained artist, but a highly accomplished frontiersman, a man who found an unshakable inspiration in the forestation of North America. staking out the landscape day after day, eagle-eyed, looking high into the trees and the skies. His name was John James Audubon.
Audubon was an impulsive, larger-than-life character and a bit of a compulsive liar. He was actually born Jean-Jacques Audubon, the illegitimate son of a French merchant and a Creole chambermaid, but that didn't stop him putting about the rumour that he was in fact descended from Dauphinois royalty. He was sent to America when he was 18 to oversee his father's estate, Mill Grove, near Philadelphia, which proved a big mistake as he squandered the family fortune on what he loved most, going out with his gun, shooting birds, and then drawing them. In fact, anyone who wanted to meet him on business was told they'd have to go and track him down in the woods. So consumed was he by his bird obsession.
Bankrupted, unsurprisingly, in 1819, Audubon threw himself into compiling a massive work of ornithology, The Birds of America. He spent 20 years making these amazingly ornate drawings of every bird under the New World sun, selling engraved prints made from his watercolour and ink originals to a keen band of subscribers. Ironically, everyone in America thought he was mad, so he had to travel to Britain to find both printer and patrons. And in a British collection at the Natural History Museum in Tring, I had a rare chance to get face to beak with some of his models. Audubon was an enthusiast for nature, but unsentimental. He killed so that he could draw, and then sold the preserved birds when money was tight.
So these are Audubon's actual own specimens?
That's right, fair by Audubon's own fair hand. Yep. He was a prolific shooter.
He said himself that a day when he shot fewer than 100 birds was a bad day.
Have they preserved their colours?
The only colours that do change are the what's called the soft parts, which the hard parts, the legs, the area around the bill colour, the eyelids. They change sometimes within hours of the bird actually dying. And this is why when Audubon was actually doing his drawings, he would use freshly killed specimens. He wouldn't actually draw unless he could help it, and time was getting precious towards the end of the project. But unless he could help it, Audubon wouldn't actually work from skins at all. He would work from freshly shot birds.
Was that the freshly shot bird? It's still bleeding. It's the most accurate. It's the most accurate version of a bird that you can get. I
mean. Yeah, in terms of the colours. Yeah.
No amount of reproduction, and Audubon's drawings are among the most reproduced artworks in American history, could ever compete with seeing the Birds of America as it was originally issued. In keeping with the project's vast ambition, Audubon insisted that every bird must be depicted life-size, so the pictures were printed on 30 by 40 inch sheets, a size known in the trade as double elephant. Audubon chose to open the series with a majestic drawing of the wild turkey. It was, in effect, a mission statement. He believed this was the most noble of all America's birds, a potent symbol of the nation's grandeur. Look out, world, it says. The turkey has landed.
There's another turkey. This is the female and this is the family, female and the chicks. It only just fits into the page margins.
But isn't that part of the power of it? That he's,
oh, yeah.
Page placement is very important, isn't it?
Absolutely,
it's a huge page and he's only just managed to squeeze it all in.
This is wonderful, this detail down here. And,
you get a very strong sense from this of Audubon's feeling for the profusion of unspoiled American nature, that there's just something going on everywhere. There.
But also, though, of course, he's showing the underside of the head. He's showing the underside of the bird, the growing feathers on the wing. He's trying to put across some ornithological knowledge here. He's showing the way the feathers all growing at once with the feather sheaths. So even though he's chosen a composition that shows a lot of drama in a family of turkeys in the wild, he is showing a lot of ornithological detail as well, getting as much information across as he can.
Looking at these works in all their flamboyant detail, it strikes me that Audubon shines as a dramatic artist as much as a natural historian. He's a master storyteller. He wants to convey something of the bloodiness of nature, red in tooth and claw. It's not simply about rigorously cataloguing wildlife. He's mythologizing it.
I love this detail of the feather.
I like that.
Just
bit,
suspended in space. It's such a daring detail, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yet it's so beautifully observed. It sort of somehow it conveys the violence of the scene more than the actual blood dripping. You know, these feathers are still flying. It's tremendous. I mean, is he inventing ornithological art as he's doing it, or is he working within an established set of conventions?
Oh, no. This sort of thing hadn't been done before. Beforehand, they were good illustrations, but they were there to show what the birds looked like. And that's all. And maybe they'd be put in, a little bit of a landscape. But the beauty of Audubon was he did more than he had to. You know, he didn't have to do this life size. He didn't have to put in all this extra detail. He took enormous risk. He did it for the sake of just wanting the thing to exist.
Wanting it to be majestic. Wanting it to be by John James Audubon and worthy of worthy of the great man. Can we look at another one?
Sure.
I want to look at all of them.
There's three more volumes after this one.
Audubon's grand project came to a close in 1839. This is one of the few remaining copies of the work in its entirety. On publication, it was so unaffordable that less than 200 sets were printed. 5 years ago, one sold at auction for almost $9 million. The Birds of America was a lifetime's work that embodied the romantic notion of America as some kind of unspoiled Eden. Audubon spoke of seeing divinity in the startling beauty of America's wildlife. Perhaps he felt that the rich variety of the birds he painted, across 435 huge pages, was vivid proof that his adopted homeland was indeed God's own country. Audubon blurred the line between scientific inquiry and spiritual quest, and it became increasingly blurred in the drawings of his contemporaries, the great romantic artists of the 19th century. They went to the natural world in search of more than physical data to study and organize. They looked with a sense of wonder and asked themselves what it might mean to feel at one with nature. No painter travelled as restlessly through the landscape as that giant of British art, Joseph Mallord William Turner. Itinerant master of all things scenic, Turner covered thousands of miles and filled hundreds of sketchbooks in search of promising subject matter for his large oil paintings. The act of sketching was initially a means to an end, but it gradually became second nature to him. So much so, you sense he almost couldn't stop himself drawing his environment, sometimes even trying to capture the views he saw while still in transit. These loose forms were put down in a matter of seconds as he made his way to one of the British landscape's most dramatic settings, Stonehenge. In many ways, it's a model subject for Turner, and to wander round Stonehenge with him in mind is to try and comprehend what stirred in him as he prowled among its remains, sketchbook in hand. I think he was drawn to this place of ancient standing stones by a sense of fellow feeling with those who created it. As he grew older, Turner's own view of nature became increasingly primeval and fixated on the elements. I'm sure the monumental, time-defying solidity of Stonehenge moved him. But I think he was even more moved by its aura of mystery and ritual. And his thoughts turned naturally to the larger movements of the universe that envelops us all.
Gradually, Turner became less and less interested in topography and more engaged in a kind of trance-like state, a state almost of reverie, with the essential aspects of nature. And he asked himself, how can I catch this? How can I catch just light and just colour on the hoof, on the run? And he turned away from conventional line drawing and he moved into watercolour.
Turner's watercolour sketchbooks aren't well known, too fragile to exhibit often, but they're among the most transcendently beautiful works of art ever created. They turn the idea of the sketch as the embryo of something else on its head. These radiant pictures are Turner's vision at its most essential, freed from line into light, through drawing with a brush instead of a pencil. They're like depictions of the world before the advent of objects. The usual subjects of 19th century art, cities, people, history, God and his heaven, had become irrelevant to him. Turner replaced them with the true eternal processes that shape nature, the flare and dissolution of light seeming to reflect the very patterns by which the universe itself was formed. Through it all runs a profound, honest sense of wonder and mystery. What does life mean? Turner doesn't know, but he watches the lights sparkle and fade. Landscape was, in many respects, the great subject of 19th century art. The English romantics looked at their surroundings, the fields and rivers, hills and trees, and found poetry there. But they also went to nature to find themselves. That's why one of the greatest of them all, John Constable, didn't just paint any landscape, but his landscape, rural Suffolk, where he was born and brought up.
Like many of the great draftsmen who've shown us something fundamentally new about the natural world and our place in it, Constable was self-taught. He was seeing things for the first time with his own eyes and working out how to draw and render them. He'd been educated at the Royal Academy schools in London, but he hadn't found it a pleasant experience. He'd been forced to study from the cast and afterlife. What he wanted to do was to get back to nature. So he threw it in and he came back to Suffolk. And he came to the landscape where he'd grown up, and he drew, and he drew, and he drew.
Constable was born here in 1776. What is now quaintly referred to as Constable Country was literally at the root of everything he drew and painted. The emotion he put into his work has been misread as nostalgia for a pre-industrial England, forever green. But drawing his native landscape wasn't for Constable a sentimental activity. He was a pragmatist and a realist. Unlike Turner, he rarely composed epic symphonies of the elements and avoided lucrative commissions to paint the estates of wealthy patrons. Concentrating on this place was about getting to the reality of life as it was lived and as it was felt.
The world that Constable drew and painted wasn't some pastoral fantasy land. It was a real working industrial landscape. And the things that he chose to draw tell us a lot about his attitudes towards it. He drew the dry docks, he drew the weirs, he drew the canals, 19th century equivalents to construction sites and motorways. He didn't disguise the fact that this was a real place in the modern world. And I think that tells us about Constable's quest. He wanted to get to the heart of the place. He wanted to get at the truth.
But his realism was shot through with a sense of mystery. He said the art of seeing nature was as much to be acquired as the art of reading the Egyptian hieroglyphs. But what did those hieroglyphs mean?
Constable wrote that no 2 days are the same, no 2 hours are the same, no 2 leaves are the same. And whereas I think of Leonardo as the great student of the mechanics of the natural process, how does the root system of a tree work? How does the valve of the heart open and close? I think of Constable as a great philosopher of the entire natural process, which he sees as a kind of endless orchestra playing out a different form of shape, movement. He sees the whole thing, and you can sense this in his drawings. He's at least as interested in the wind that moves the tree as he is in the tree itself. He wants to paint the changeability of the world.
Constable's greatest achievement was to fold his own feelings into his depictions of nature. When he draws a tree, its limbs dancing in the wind, he creates a metaphor for the ever-changing world of human emotions. And those emotions can be pretty complicated and personal. In the early 1820s, when his wife was slowly dying of dreadful emphysema, he became positively obsessed with trying to capture effects of breeziness and airiness in a series of incredible drawings. It's as if he was trying to fill her lungs with air using the medium of art. His motto was, "Painting is another word for feeling." And I think the same's true of his drawings. Looking at them, there's so much feeling in them that it's very difficult to know what exactly you're looking at. You're certainly not just looking at something that Constable once had in front of his eyes. You're looking at his own responses, his own emotions mingled with that. And I think that's the whole point. What Constable's saying is that you can't separate yourself from the natural world that you inhabit. Jackson Pollock in the 1950s said, "I am nature," which is a pretty radical thing to say. But Constable said it first in his art, and it changed everything. The Romantics lived in an age of declining religious belief. Instead of going to church to be spiritually uplifted, they went to nature. And I think you can sense in their work that God and man have only just parted company. We live in a very different world. There's not much God in it, and much less nature. Often just fragments of green at the concrete margin. The very idea of catching sight of heaven in a wild flower seems fancifully remote. An artist whose drawings I think brilliantly capture this creeping sense of disenchantment is George Shaw. I think of him as the Constable of the Council Estate.
When I went to an art gallery at the age of 14, I didn't see my world in the art gallery. So you would go down to the Tate, like the proper Tate, and there would be like pictures on the walls of Victorians or something, you know, kings and queens or idyllic cornfields. And you think, where's my life then? Maybe my life isn't worth anything, really. What you saw in the gallery was not your world. So you stepped out of your world into the gallery. So I thought, what's wrong with just drawing the thing that's just open your window and draw the thing which is there? And if you don't find it beautiful, that's your fault.
I think Shaw's work is beautiful, and fittingly, it is now on the walls of the Tate. His pictures are rooted in the streets of Tile Hill, a suburb just outside Coventry, where he grew up. But they're not just uncannily accurate depictions of this place. They're descriptions of a mood. Modern man, alienated, in a largely man-made landscape. And just as the physical world has changed remarkably since the days of Turner and Constable, so too has the artist's sense of capturing his own place in it. You won't catch George Shaw sketching by the roadside in Tile Hill. He doesn't even live there anymore. Everything is done in a seaside studio in North Devon, from humble snapshot photographs that might have been taken many years before.
Certain people I've talked to would quite like me to work like an old-fashioned artist. You know, sitting there with an easel or a sketchbook making concise notes. I think they like the fact that there might be somebody working away like that might plug into that romantic notion. The reality is I kind of skulk around with a very small camera, quite furtively. I want to do the job quickly. I want to be in and out, really. I don't want to... I'm not a solitary stroller wandering around seeking inspiration. I had that. I had the inspiration. I've just got to do the work now. So I feel much more like a hunter, really. I started off with an idea that I would make work about the place where I came from. And as it's sort of gone on, it's become less to do with memory or to do with a thing which has gone, and much more to do with me in the present looking back at something which probably isn't there. The natural world that appears in my work is always secondhand. It's had another life, it's getting processed, and it's slightly used up. The sun doesn't illuminate anything. The brick walls don't protect anything. The grass doesn't grow. It's all been fetishized. Its purpose has been completely removed. It's just a totally painted, non-existent world, really. I mean, I've got sketchbooks and books of drawings going back years, and what I find looking at them is each one's like a gravestone, really. Each one's like a slightly, is a marker in time or a little memento mori.
Shaw's landscapes are filled with melancholic beauty, a sense of longing, a frozen, slightly unreal mood. Even at their most tranquil, like this watercolour filled with glowing evening light, there's a creeping tension to them, as if life is somehow elsewhere. Their sadness comes, I think, from Shaw's knowledge that you can't actually freeze time. Like Constable, he recognises that the world is ever-changing, only he doesn't celebrate that. He laments it, seeing the change as a loss. I think these pictures are about the end of innocence, about never being able to go home. But they're also a way of giving all the ghosts an afterlife in lines on paper.
What is odd is Tarlhilt did stay the same for what seemed like years. And it all started to be taken apart, regenerated, for the better in a lot of the areas. But it was odd to see pubs that have been there for my lifetime just raised to the ground, and there's probably not a single image of it, except for the drawing. Now, that's not much to brag about, I know. That's not like I played for England or something. But, you know, I've documented a place that probably would have been completely invisible. But also, I've probably documented a life which would have been quite invisible, which my life, I suppose, in a way. If only for my own benefits. And I've given it due time and attention, I think.
In our frenetic modern world, it's a lot harder to get back to nature than it once was, although it's still not impossible. And the simple joy of being in a beautiful environment will never really fade. But what's left for the artist nowadays to say about the landscape? This line of stones is a work by the British artist Richard Long. Long's work enjoys an exalted reputation in the international art world, while evoking sensations that go back to a time beyond even the Renaissance, to a primitive, primal response to the basic materials of the earth.
What I really like about Richard Long's work is its combination of austerity and simplicity. He's an artist who crosses lines. He takes drawing into the realm of sculpture. And I think what animates his work is the desire actually to take drawing as close to nature as he possibly can, to the extent that he actually draws with fragments of nature, these pieces of flint. What you get is simply a line drawn in the grass rather than on a piece of paper. A very simple gesture, but one that I think expresses Long's whole ambition. He points us into the heart of the landscape.
Long began working with the earth and the land in the late 1960s, making art from ephemeral materials, grass, water. Pretty soon he turned to walking up and down, to making marks on the Earth's surface, physically drawing his own trace. He likes the great vistas of our world, forests, mountains, deserts. He's talked about how he finds himself thinking about nothing, how drawing by walking liberates the mind. It's just man, the land, and nothing else. Long's a modern nomad, working or walking on all our behalfs, so we can get back to nature through his example. There's something very direct and pure about his forms. Basic lines, circles, echoes of the mutability of nature, traces that will be blown away by the wind and disappear as time passes. More recently, he's taken to making drawings with organic pigments, particularly mud from the River Avon near his home. There's a visceral delight in this playing with natural materials, like a child might take in making a sandcastle. Looked at on a bigger scale, his huge compositions of carefully hand-smeared mud bring to mind the elemental art of cave painters. Long's pared-down abstract language crosses a great divide, combining modern art with something timeless, ancient. There's a strong connection with Turner feeling his way around Stonehenge, but with Long aspiring to be a kind of modern caveman, creating stone circles, ritual sites. You can see it in this line of jagged slates, themselves covered by fossils, like drawings made by nature.
It's as if he's created a work from slices of geological time, a way of making us think about the larger processes of nature that shape the world. And I think the whole sculpture, drawing, whatever you call it, is a kind of epitome of natural violence. It feels like a structure that could have been shaped by the clashing of tectonic plates. It's a way of making us aware of the vast forces underneath the earth, putting us in touch with the cosmic power of nature.
Long's work draws the story of man's relation to the natural world back full circle and puts it in the largest perspective of all, that of the sheer inexplicable mystery of life, the universe, and everything. Ever since the Renaissance, drawing has shaped our knowledge of nature in all kinds of dynamic ways. But sometimes, as Socrates said, the truly wise man is he who admits that he knows nothing. Sometimes, the most eloquent line is the simple mark that disappears as soon as it is made.
There's more Secrets of Drawing next week at the earlier time of 8:05. And if you've been inspired by this programme and want to know more, go to bbc.co.uk/secretofdrawing. Also on BBC4 now, a profile of Renaissance artist Michelangelo.